Okay, so thanks. Thank you for you as a field for inviting me with open arms. So what's the fundamental problem of short-term memory? So basically, at a cognitive level, we can remember multiple stimuli over the time course of seconds, like speech, phone numbers, things like that. But isolated neurons tend to forget their synaptic inputs in the time course of milliseconds, unless, of course, there's something like membrane bistability or something like that. So the question is, to mediate short-term memory, networks of neurons must essentially interact with each other to keep our memories alive. And so what kind of interactions are capable of extending single neuron memory to cognitive timescales? And most importantly for this talk, how can networks of neurons store multiple items in a temporal sequence? Okay, so one of the main ideas that has dominated our field is the idea of positive feedback. So if single neurons can't maintain their firing rates, you can imagine that a network of neurons giving each other positive feedback could maintain their firing rate. So a single stimulus comes in, it excites a subset of neurons if they recurrently excite each other, and at the same time inhibit other neurons that are not part of the set of neurons that are meant to represent a stimulus. Then this network of neurons, this subnetwork of neurons, could keep the memory alive. And of course, this was the essential idea proposed by John Hopfield in the 70s, where he brought together a bunch of work to give us the idea that essentially stable memories of a single item could be stored as essentially fixed points or stable patterns of activity in a recurrent network, right? Later on, this was extended to the idea of storing analog information, like our eye position, for example, in a line attractor, possibly localized in our brainstem or our cerebellum. And again, the same idea is positive feedback. It could arise at a network level, at a single cell level, and we're not sure yet what actually occurs in the brain. However, this can't be the end of memory, the end of the story of working memory, because one of the richest aspects of our cognitive experience is our ability to remember sequences. For example, you know, music, poetry, phone numbers, and probably a less rich experience is the words that I'm saying to you right now. All right, so how do we remember sequences? Clearly, these types of networks, positive feedback alone is not up to the task, because if you give such a network a sequence of stimuli, the final stimuli will place the network in the stable pattern of activity corresponding to that object, thereby erasing immediately all previous memory of previous items in the sequence. Right? So we need a new kind of a more dynamical theory of sequence memory. But actually, what occurs in the actual brain when the sequence memory, for example, of a macaque is probed? Right, so there's actually very little work done on sequence memory, but here's a very interesting piece of work where essentially a monkey was trained to perform a delayed match to sequence task. So the monkey was shown a first object, then a second object, and then, so this is the sample sequence, and then the monkey was shown a test sequence. And the monkey was supposed to do one motor action if the test sequence matched the sample sequence both in object identity and object order. But if there was a non-match, it was supposed to perform another motor action. So what do neurons do when they're faced with this kind of a task? So here's an example of a single neuron recorded in the prefrontal cortex. So these neurons show selectivity for the object. So for example, when you show the first cue, this particular neuron, the response during the first cue, it had selectivity. So it fired most to object D, and then fired less to C, and then A, and then B. Right? Now, what happens to this neuron's activity during the first object delay period? It shows exactly the same pattern of activity. So this is what we all know and love. A stimulus elicits a pattern of activity in our brain, and that same pattern of activity persists after the stimulus is gone. Right? However, we can ask, how does this same neuron encode the first object after the second object has been loaded onto the network? Right? So during this delay period, you can average over the presentation of the first object, of the second object, and ask, what is the response of the neuron as a function of the first object? And so this is the response during the first object cue, repeated over here. But strikingly, this neuron shows a completely different pattern of selectivity during the second object delay period. So this neuron actually reverses its selectivity. And in general, for the many, many neurons that recorded, this was sort of typical. There was no stereotype relation between the internal representation of the first object during the first object delay period relative to the second object delay period. So what does this mean?
Is it because the second object was almost never the same as the first object in this?
There were repeats as well, actually.
There were repeats?
Yeah. And the whole task was randomized so that averaging should average out the identity of the second object, right? So what this means, yeah, Sophie?
Prefrontal cortex or
IC? Prefrontal cortex, right? So what this means is if you wanted to decode the identity of the first object, the pattern of firing rates you'd look for here versus the pattern of firing rates you'd look for here are completely different, right? Say if you were to do linear discriminant analysis to pick out whether or not object D was the first object, right? So essentially, the internal representation of the same object is changing over time as more and more objects are loaded onto the network. So one kind of a theoretical paradigm, an interesting theoretical paradigm that Markram, Nachtschlager, and Maas, and also Herbert Jaeger came up with, was the idea of a liquid brain or equistate hypothesis. They suggested that maybe the problem of sequence memory is not so hard. Maybe a recurrence, any complex recurrent circuit essentially just automatically absorbs and stores information from the incoming input stream. And also Jaeger had a similar idea. So a useful analogy to keep in mind is essentially the surface of water. It's a dynamical system, it obeys the wave equation, but you can just tell by looking at the current state of the pattern of activity on the surface of the water, you can actually infer the entire sequence of inputs thrown into the water. Right? So for example, from the radius of this outermost ripple, you can infer the time at which an object was thrown in. From the amplitude of the ripple, you can recover something about the mass of the object. And if there are multiple objects thrown in, all the information is there ready for you to decode.
So this requires, as what Fred was saying last week, that you can't have a chaotic system, or at least not one that loses information too fast?
Exactly, yeah. In this particular case, chaos is not useful for us.
Yep. Right? How many stones in this space?
Here there were
one, in the front and
one
in the
two, three, maybe. So, okay, then there's an issue of noise.
One in the front.
Yeah.
Not important.
Yeah, you guys want to have wine and cheese, right?
Look at the shape of the toilet.
All right.
The corridor.
We'll get to these kind of questions in the context of neural networks. So a simulation that Maas and company did was they took a temporal input, fed it through some feed-forward connectivity into a recurrent network. And for example, they had a network of about 135 neurons. They had a membrane time constant of about 20 milliseconds and synaptic time constants of about 1 second. And they put in temporal inputs and asked from the current state of the network, how far back in the past can you reconstruct the inputs? And they were able to get a good memory of about order a second, right? So this is an interesting simulation, but the question is this a victory or can we do better, right? So without a good theory of how sequence memory can be stored in this sort of post-hoc Fieldian paradigm, we need to essentially come up with a theory to understand how the memory properties of a network depend on the connectivity and noise and so on in the system. So what the goals of this talk are the following. We want to generate a theoretical framework in which we can even define the memory capacity of such networks. We want to compute this capacity analytically, understand its dependence on circuit connectivity and noise in the system. And I think this is an important point in view of the talks that we got in the beginning on connectomics. We don't know yet what to do with connectomics data, but one thing we can do before the data starts coming online is to actually try to construct theories of how neural connectivity affects neuronal function. And this will be one modest example of that, of how neuronal connectivity affects memory. Right? We want to extract fundamental performance limits or trade-offs in the system, and we want to find and understand optimal networks which achieve these performance limits. So this is a lot to ask for, so we're going to look at, but because this is sort of a new paradigm, we're going to look at the simplest type of dynamics and try to understand it fully. So we're going to imagine a dynamical system where a temporal input, S, which is, for now is just operating in discrete time, this can all be generalized to continuous time, a discrete signal, S, is coming into a network, goes through a feed-forward connectivity, and gets processed through a recurrent connectivity. So this is literally the dynamics of the system. Z is some noise, and an important parameter in all of this is the signal-to-noise ratio, 1 over epsilon. So 1 is the variance of the signal at any given time. Epsilon is the variance of the noise, any component of the noise at a given time. And so the question is, so let's say two different signals or three different signals come into this network. After a certain time, at the current time n, these three different signals will lead to three different distributions of the network state. And the extent to which these three distributions are different measures intuitively the extent to which the current network state encodes or remembers the signals.
Is W a linear transformation?
W is a matrix, an n by n matrix.
It makes our lives much easier.
Yeah, it makes our lives much easier.
Does it matter over which time scale you're going to measure this p of xn?
So the idea is in discrete time we just want one time slice. In continuous time we would just measure the activity over one membrane time constant.
Okay.
That's the idea.
And V is a vector, right?
And V is a vector, right. And importantly the norm of V is 1. So this relates to the signal power being 1. Okay, so now in such a framework, how do we even define memory? Right, so there's two dual ways to define memory. One, memory is our ability to use the present state to reconstruct the past. And this is a viewpoint that was taken in this paper. And they were able to make considerable progress, but this definition of memory analytically is quite complicated. So it was not possible to analyze general networks in this paper. A dual viewpoint of memory is the ability of the past to change the present. So for example, if I were to wiggle the past input slightly, that would change the network state. And if I wiggled the past a little bit and the network state changed a lot, then in principle, the current network state contains a lot of information about what the past input was. So this essential intuition is captured by the Fisher information matrix, which you know is a well-defined quantity that has shown up a lot in studies of population coding. So the basic idea behind Fisher information is, let's say you take the signal, this is a vector in time, and you perturb it by a certain perturbation ds, right? Then the distribution of x of n will change by amount given quadratically by this times j times this, right? So the idea is the Fisher information captures how much the distribution changes when you change the past input. So of course this is a matrix.
Go back to a chaotic system.
Right.
Is that a good definition for a chaotic system? You really?
Yeah. So there's noise in this as well, right? So actually the Fisher information will be quite small. There, because remember the Fisher information is essentially like a signal to noise ratio. Exactly. So if you amplify the signal, which the positively up and up exponents will do, they will also amplify noise, so it's not obvious what will happen to the Fisher information.
It doesn't appear in your definition, but that seems like
it appears implicitly here because I'm looking at the distribution of the network state given the past. So the noise is all in there. We'll see examples of this.
It's a bit more complicated if I could go back to Adrian's question, because right. Even if the system is chaotic, it will be expanding in some directions but contracting in others, while the noise presumably will be expanding in all directions, right? So
right.
This balance, you have to know which are the directions in which the system is not contracting the dynamics, even if it is chaotic.
Well, I mean, if the signal contracts in a certain direction, the noise will also contract in that direction.
The noise will also contract? I thought the noise would always expand.
I mean, contract or expand. Right?
Yeah.
The both the signal and noise are shaped by the same Lyapunov exponents. So
depends on where you insert the noise.
It depends on where, yeah. So let's get back to this after the end of the talk. Yeah. So what is it? Just this is a very abstract definition. So what does this mean? Well, this is a matrix, right? So why should I ask you to think of memory as encoded in a matrix, aside from three Hollywood movies, which tell you that all our memories are part of a matrix? I just saw Matrix Reloaded yesterday. It was pretty cool. Anyway, so what do the matrix elements mean, right? So it turns out that the diagonal of these elements means something very, very simple, right? Let's say you were to put in a single pulse into the network. And you are to ask how much information the network at time n retains about that pulse after it's percolated through the network k time steps. This literally is JKK, and you can think of it literally as a signal-to-noise ratio. How much signal-to-noise is present in the embedding of that pulse in the current network state? Right? The off-diagonal elements actually tell you something about interference. If you put two pulses into the network at two different times, eventually they'll collide with each other in the current network state. And JKL tells you the interference between two pulses that enter the network at times K and L in the past. I'm not going to focus on this for the purpose of this talk. I'm just going to focus on the diagonal, the memory curve. And essentially a simple measure of the memory is essentially the area under the memory curve. This essentially represents the integrated ability of a network to remember a pulse of input. Or alternatively, you can think of this as the total signal-to-noise ratio present in the current network state about the entire past signal history, because it's just the trace of the Fisher information matrix.
Can I ask you a really stupid question?
Sure.
Could you go one backward, maybe two back, I guess, one more back. So the reason why you don't have a linear term is because you assume you're at the maximum of the probability distributions.
A linear term where?
Now, go one forward. So when I twiggle one s at n minus k, why doesn't p change to first order?
Yeah, so first of all, there's an alternative formula in terms of first order. And you can think of this as an expansion of the KL divergence. And because you're exactly expanding at a minimum, you only get a quadratic
term. I should think of it as a perturbation.
Right. Well, it's this the first order contribution to the perturbation is quadratic.
It's quadratic.
Right. Yeah.
Can't you also get something about one from the Fisher information matrix via the Kramer?
Yeah. So there's a relationship between the two dual viewpoints on memory. The Fisher information bounds your ability to reconstruct the input through the Kramer output. Yeah, it's related to that,
right?
Not from the trace. It's a more complicated function. So the reason this is much simpler is because this doesn't depend on the input statistics, and it doesn't depend on the off-diagonal elements, which can be complicated.
Uh-huh. Is there a justification to use the trace? Because, for example, in a population of their own, the correlation can completely change your Fisher information, and sometimes
this is all encoded in the correlation. All the correlations are encoded, even in the trace.
In the trace.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'll give you a form. I'll tell you what.
Something I was wondering about, or I used to wonder about, but then forgot. Okay. Suppose x was a 1D variable.
Right.
So x of n plus 1 equals 0 plus signal plus noise.
Right.
In that case, basically, any signal that comes in just pushes x up and down, right?
Right.
So
there I'll show you that the area under this memory curve can never be bigger than 1 over epsilon.
No, the point is, that's not what I was going to ask. Okay. So the point is, in that case, if you want to know when something happened, then the different JKKs really get mixed up. If you get a pulse here or a pulse one step later, they have pretty much the same signal, right?
So if you want to
massively overestimates how well you're doing. And that's because the off-diagonal elements are massively correlated.
Yeah, that's right. But you better have a large trace in order to even do the next step.
So the trace is an upper bound, but
it's an upper bound, yeah.
It could be much worse. In this case, the trace doesn't really help you much at all, right? Because you can't tell when things.
So what the trace is doing is it's telling you how well you can remember a single pulse. What the off diagonals tell you is how much interference there are between multiple pulses. And if you do have multiple pulses, you'll have to take into account the off diagonals. And you can write down everything that you care about, reconstruction error, mutual information between current and the past, all in terms of the diagonals, the off diagonals, and the input statistics. So there's formulas for that. Okay, so because everything is so simple, you can actually analytically compute the Fisher information as a function of the network connectivity. And the good news is that there's a formula, but the bad news is it's a very complicated formula. So the reason this problem is rich and challenging is because there's a nonlinear relationship between the connectivity of the network, W and V, and the memory, J, right? Even though the dynamics is linear. And this has to do with the recurrency of the circuit. So the fundamental goal of this talk is to understand this nonlinear relationship between connectivity and memory. Right? So despite the complexity of this relationship, our first result is that we can prove a result that's true for any network within this class. It turns out that the memory capacity, or the area under the memory curve, for any network, no matter what kind of recurrent or feed-forward connectivity you choose, is less than n over epsilon. So intuitively, what does this mean? The instantaneous SNR entering the system is 1 over epsilon, right? So what this means is, it is in principle possible to convert purely temporal information into spatial information up to about n time steps.
What's
right?
n?
N is the number of neurons, right? So basically, this suggests that no network can remember more than roughly n units of information. But unfortunately, this proof is non-constructive. It doesn't tell us which W and which V are capable of achieving this fundamental limit. The fundamental question is this limit easy to get to? Can any network do it? Right? For example, the conjecture of Maas and company was that maybe random Gaussian networks are good networks. And the next thing is, even if it's hard to do it, can we find a network that gets to this limit?
So yeah, just to make sure, attractive networks would be a particular case of this genus.
Exactly, and I'll tell you how they fit in.
Is this all assuming there's no inhibition? Is lateral inhibition?
No, so W can be positive or negative. So there can be excitation inhibition in the network. So this is a theorem that's true for any W whatsoever. So any pattern of excitation inhibition you could ever conceive of. Again, within this limited class of dynamics.
Can you just remind of the dynamical equations?
Yeah, so Let me write those down. So this is the setup.
Can you turn the lights on?
Okay. Again, the variance of this is epsilon. The covariance of this is a diagonal matrix with the diagonal elements epsilon. The variance of this is 1, right at each time step. Okay. So the first question is it trivial to achieve this limit? And the answer is actually no. There's a large class of networks that we always think of when we do either physics or theoretical neuroscience that actually have horrible memory performance. So this is sort of the first surprising result. Assume that W is normal. Okay, mathematically what this means is W has an orthogonal basis of eigenvectors. Right? I'll give you examples of normal matrices in the next slide. But basically, for this class of matrices, it turns out that the memory performance only depends on the eigenvalues of W, or essentially the spectrum of network time constants available to you in the network. It doesn't depend on the structure of the eigenvectors. And it turns out for all of these, any network of this form, the memory capacity is simply just 1 over epsilon. Right? And this is independent of W and independent of V, as long as, of course, V is normalized to be 1. That corresponds to the signal strength being 1.
It's like half filled networks with
exactly.
symmetric
exactly.
immediately
exactly.
the normal class.
Right.
So you lose
although,
that
I mean, these are linear networks, Hopfield is nonlinear, so it's slightly different, but yeah.
So you lose a factor of n.
You lose a factor of n. So essentially, the punchline is normal networks cannot retain in the network state more signal-to-noise ratio about the entire past signal history than the instantaneous signal-to-noise ratio that enters the network at any one time.
Is this the naive way? Is this just saying that if you have a recurrent network, you just always converge to the dominant eigenvalue, and that's the 1?
Yeah, I mean, there may not be 1 dominant eigenvalue, but I'll give you exact intuition for why this is. Yeah, it has to do with the weakness of recurrent feedback. Yeah, I'll tell you how, intuition for why this holds. But first, what are some examples of normal networks? So any symmetric network is normal. Any anti-symmetric network, any orthogonal network, any translation invariant lattice, it doesn't have to be symmetric, but if it's translation invariant, this is normal because the eigenvectors are Fourier modes.
Well, if it's translation invariant with a scalar at each node, if there's a vector at each node, it doesn't have to be. Or if you have an E and an I at each node, then it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll get to your stuff, yeah. But then I would, yeah, sure. So, yeah, but that would mean there's 2 neurons here, right? An E and an E, right, yeah. So just this kind of a network is normal. And if you think of a gross caricature of a cortical surface as a locally connected lattice, that will be normal, right? As long as there's symmetry, or you know, along this lattice.
But right. Again, so, that won't be true as soon as you consider an E and an I cell.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll get to that. Right.
It has to be a perfect lattice.
Well, yeah. So you can do.
It's a lattice. It could be a perfect lattice, but just with an E and an I cell at each point.
Right.
And then it won't be normal.
But it's not clear that the memory will be order n. Right?
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, you can. Whoa. Sorry.
The world out there, I hope it didn't break your ears.
Okay, so. Don't break. Okay. So, clearly, we need to go away from normality. We need to get away from these normal networks. So the next thing you could imagine is that you could just have a random matrix, right? So this is the optimistic idea that maybe random networks can give us sequence memory. So clearly, if I just choose W to be a random matrix, it's not normal. So now a new phenomenon arises. The memory capacity depends not only in the network connectivity, but also the way that the signal enters the network through the feed-forward connectivity. So what I did was I picked random matrices, and for a given random matrix, I tried to optimize the memory capacity by optimizing over the feed-forward connectivity. It turns out this is a quadratic optimization problem. It can be done numerically. There's no issues of local maxima. And this is what I get. Right? So the memory capacity optimized over the feed-forward connectivity for a network of 100 neurons turns out only to be around 3.5 in units of 1 over epsilon, in units of the signal to noise entering the network. So any normal network will be here. And if I optimize over V, I get a modest improvement about 3.5. Right? This is sort of the same order of magnitude that Maas and company got. However, N was 100. Right? So the fundamental limit is way out there. And so clearly, random networks are not capable of achieving the fundamental limit.
So that's J tilde over epsilon or something.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So clearly the problem of getting sequence memory is non-trivial in this framework. So we know we need to be non-normal to get sequence memory. So in order to understand why non-normality is required, we need to understand something about non-normal dynamics. Right. So first of all, what is the nature of normal dynamics? Essentially, because the eigenvectors are orthogonal, you can essentially expand the network activity in the orthogonal basis of eigenvectors of W. And whatever the initial expansion coefficients will be, over time, each of them will just decay away, right? Because we demand stability of the system. So in discrete time, stability means the eigenvalues have to be less than 1 in absolute value. So you get exponential decay. And in generally, the total network activity must monotonically decrease over time. This is a hallmark feature of normal dynamics. So again, you can think of the network dynamics as just n independent modes, where each mode exerts positive feedback on itself. What happens in non-normal dynamics? Now the eigenvectors are, oh, sorry. So this is your question, Sophie. The line attractor network, a very simple version, is where all the neurons excite each other. So there's one uniform slow mode, and the network will settle along the slow mode and decay away slowly. This is sort of a canonical example of memory, and it's great for storing the sum of your inputs, but it's horrible for storing the entire input sequence. For non-normal dynamics, because the eigenvectors are not orthogonal, even though the expansion coefficients will decay away, it turns out that the network activity can transiently increase before it decays. This is the new feature that occurs in non-normal dynamics. I'll skip the intuition for that, but I'll give you a different intuition. Oh, and the other thing is, this is Ken's work, which I'll say more about later. So non-normality is actually a generic feature of excitatory inhibitory networks, and you can get this kind of transient amplification there as well. And I'll let Ken, you'll probably talk something about that this Thursday. Okay, so what's the general picture? What's the picture you should take home with you? So this is from a review article that Peter and I wrote about some other work, which I'll tell you about soon. So the key idea behind non-normal networks is you have independent modes of activity. For non-normal networks, what you end up doing is you can't diagonalize the system because we're using an orthogonal transformation, because the eigenmodes are not orthogonal to each other. The most you can do by an orthogonal transformation is make the network upper triangular, the connectivity matrix upper triangular. What does that mean? It means that in this basis, the network has a hidden feed-forward structure, right? You have modes of activity, each of which are orthogonal, and the time evolution looks like a feed-forward flow down the cascade of neurons, right? There may be some positive feedback each mode exerts on itself, but roughly there's a feed-forward flow as well. So for example, a delay line is a canonical example of a non-normal network. But not every non-normal network, of course, is manifestly feed-forward. For example, here's a complicated recurrent circuit. It turns out that for this recurrent circuit, you can find 4 patterns of activity, such that if you excite the network in this activity pattern, it will drive another activity pattern and another activity pattern and another activity pattern in a feed-forward chain. So if you look at the dynamical response of this network to a pulse of excitation to all 4 neurons, each neuron will show a complex dynamical trajectory over time, much like the way the monkey data showed. But if you were able to find the modes of activity that correspond to these preferred orthogonal modes, and you replotted the activity in this basis, you'd see initial excitation of this first pattern that decays away, but before it decays away, it transfers information to the next pattern, and the next pattern, and so on. So you get activity that lasts quite a long time. Okay, so this is the feature of non-normal networks that's new compared to normal networks, this hidden feed-forward structure.
So how do you get decay? How do you get activity to go back down?
Because eventually the network is stable. So at long timescales, everything must decay away. But at short timescales, you can get amplification.
The constraint of your networks, they have to...
Yeah, I demand that the networks be stable.
Right. In this case, P5 is 0.
So essentially, this pattern of activity doesn't excite anything else.
Okay.
Sure decomposition. Sorry. These modes are called the Sure decomposition, and yeah, you can look it up and you'll get more details about it in Wikipedia. All
right.
And it's all, I think it's also right. So there's a lot of history behind non-normal work. So of course, non-normal dynamics has a long history in physics and biology, and there's a beautiful book by Trefethen and Embre that describes non-normal systems, and they've received a lot of attention because of their rich transient dynamics. So essentially at the same time there were these three papers that, so the work I'm talking about is this work right here, and Brendan Murphy and Ken Miller had a very nice piece of work where they showed that non-normality was a generic feature of any kind of excitatory inhibitory network. So essentially non-normality is a intrinsic property of our brain networks. And Mark had some work very closely related to ours, looking at how integration could be implemented by non-normal networks. And again, Peter and I wrote a review article on this. And actually, it was Ken Miller who directly and indirectly told both Mark and me about the existence of non-normal networks, who told us about this reference. So we owe Ken a lot for actually alerting us to the existence of this class of networks. Okay, so that's our crash course on non-normal networks. So now let's go back to the big picture. So we've uncovered this sort of dichotomy between two types of networks. At an information theoretic or memory level, normal networks are horrible. They cannot perform sequence memory. And this turns out to be all the networks that we sort of think of when we do neuroscience. Their dynamics must decay. So the sum squared activity of all the neurons must decay over time, and their hidden structure is just independent modes interacting, independent modes exerting positive feedback on themselves. Non-normal networks have this transient amplification and a hidden feed-forward structure. So the question is, can we exploit this dynamical feature and this structural feature in order to achieve this information theoretic limit? This is the question. So let's take the most obvious network possible, the delay line now, and let's analyze that to death. So let's assume that we have a delay line. So this is just a connectivity where each synapse has the same strength for simplicity. And let's say that the gain or the strength is less than one. Then what happens, right? So the signal propagates through the network. Let's say you put the signal in at the beginning. It propagates through the network, and because the gain is less than one, the signal exponentially decays. Right? What happens to the noise? Essentially, because noise is entering the system at all neurons at all times, if you look from the perspective of any one neuron, it receives noise from all upstream neurons, but only receives noise from a finite number of upstream neurons because of the decay. So the noise remains order one across the whole network. So then Fisher information is again signal to noise, so the signal to noise is decaying exponentially, and its area is order one. Right, so in such a network, no matter how large you make the network, you can only remember anything for order one time steps. Okay, so what if we try to combat this problem of decay, right? What if we try to fine-tune the system to make the gain one? So then this is great. The signal will propagate through without decaying. So this seems good. But now the noise picture changes. A single neuron here will receive noise from all upstream neurons without decay. So the variance of the noise of this neuron will increase linearly with the depth of the network. And so the noise will increase linearly. The signal to noise will decay like a power law, one over time, or equivalently one over distance, because time and distance are so intimately connected in this network. And then, so the integral of that is logarithmic in that. Okay. So now you can get memory.
I'm a little bit confused. So you're assuming that the signal is
the signal is I'm assuming the signal is entering in the beginning. Exactly.
But the noise is being injected.
The noise is injected everywhere. Right.
But so suppose you have a propagating wave. You have a large network, extended network, network of neurons,
right.
And you have a propagating wave. So the wave does not decay, does not expand, it just propagates.
Right.
So.
Right, so that's analogous to this case, right? But if there's noise entering everywhere.
If there is noise?
But so then the noise will expand downstream, right? So then the signal to noise ratio will decay and the memory will be logarithmic in the size of the system. So ironically, this is actually what seems to be occurring in Elisha Moses' culture. I don't know if he's here, but he seemed to get a signal to noise. So he had a culture in which he had a chain of neurons, and the signal to noise seemed to decay as one over distance into the network. Okay, so this is bad. Well, I mean, it's sort of good. It's better than order one, but it's only logarithmic in the number of neurons. So what if we try to do something that might seem crazy at first? Let's try to crank up the gain to be bigger than one. Okay, so this is great. The signal exponentially explodes, right? But the noise also exponentially explodes. So it's not clear what will happen to the signal-to-noise ratio. However, there's a fundamental asymmetry between signal and noise in this network. The signal enters at the beginning, so it achieves the maximum sort of possible level of amplification, whereas the noise is distributed all over the network, so it's not amplified as much as the signal. And if you work out the math, it turns out that the signal-to-noise ratio asymptotes to a finite quantity, no matter how large you make the network. And so it turns out, so then the area under the memory curve will be order n. Okay? So this is the first network that we've seen that achieves the promise of sequence memory, i.e. the memory grows with the number of neurons.
So
yeah.
You don't necessarily want your neighbors to be stable then?
Well, you get exponential growth Say it again?
How will we deal with
that? Oh, that's because all the eigenvalues of this thing are zero, right? So you'll get exponential growth for order n time steps, but eventually after order n time steps, you'll decay away. So this network is stable, but it has this strong transient amplification. It turns out if you work out the math, you don't actually need exponential growth, you only need linear growth, and then the signal to noise will actually asymptote to finite quantity.
Is that because you suppose your signal is a pulse, actually? So the duration of your input is
S thing,
is short, so it's okay. But if you were to keep feeding some signal...
So the other interesting thing about this network is that the Fisher information matrix is a diagonal. There's no interference between two pulses because they enter the network and propagate along without ever colliding. So you can actually remember the entire sequence, of course, in a delay line, right?
Is this equivalent to having a recurrent network of neurons that have intrinsic burst
units? I don't know how to answer that question.
Like burst transduction?
It depends on how detailed you. So it's equivalent to essentially firing rates increasing over time. Right. That's the idea.
Essentially, here, the network is linear. I mean, the transformation matrix is a matrix.
Right.
So if it's not non-linear, then.
So I'll say something about non-linear networks afterwards.
So I'm confused where you get the n. It looks like signal and noise are growing identically.
Yeah, you should be confused. It's not obvious, and you have to do the mathematics.
Okay, but I mean, intuitively, why are...
So again, the best intuition I can give you right now is that the signal enters at the beginning, so it receives the maximum amplification. The noise, if you think of it here, the noise, where is the noise at this neuron coming from? Well, it comes from this neuron at the previous time step, but that only gets one unit of amplification. It comes from this neuron two time steps ago, and you sum that series, and you look at the numerator and denominator, and you'll see that as long as this activity increases linearly, or faster, the signal-to-noise ratio will asymptote to 1.
I guess what's confusing me is the noise you inject at the first node.
Right.
You have some signal-to-noise ratio to reject the signal.
So the Fisher information
is the same because the noise is growing just.
So the Fisher information will asymptote to that.
So it's whatever signal-to-noise you
exactly.
Inject.
Well, it'll asymptote to some fraction of that.
But then how do you get n?
So it asymptotes to a fraction of the initial SNR, where that fraction is order 1. So when you sum over.
Now you're saying those
is order 1. The initial SNR is order 1.
Yeah, so how do you get n?
So you. Sum over.
Asymptote to the initial SNR, which was order 1.
Right. So the thing that's confusing is that JKK asymptotes to something order 1, and the memory is the sum over K.
JKK. Surya, in this picture, each one of these dots, it's a mode or a neuron?
Okay, so you can think of it either way. Right now, I've said that this is a neuron, but of course, everything, including the Fisher information, is invariant up to unitary orthogonal transformations. So you could equivalently think of this as patterns of activity, and this could be a very complicated recurrent network. Anatomically, it doesn't need to look like a delay line. The fundamental thing is you have these modes of activity that transfer information to other modes of activity, and even the network response to a single pulse will change over time.
It has to be at least linear growth because of what you wrote there, right?
Yes.
It has to be at least linear.
Yeah, that's right. Now, this is bad, okay, because of course, we can't expect neurons to have arbitrarily high firing rates. So this isn't a biologically plausible solution. But you can ask the question, am I suffering from a lack of imagination? I gave you just one network that could do this. Maybe I missed something, and maybe there's some other network that could do this in a more biologically plausible way. And the main result, one of the main results of this work, is that I proved a theorem saying that no, I'm not suffering from a lack of imagination. It turns out that every network obeys this constraint.
Sorry, just in this case.
Just in within this class of models. Right? So, yeah, no, but generally I'm always suffering from lack of imagination, right?
Yeah, that's a different theorem.
Yeah, you know, that's, yeah. You proved that theorem, right? So imagine an arbitrary network. So this is the statement of the theorem. Imagine an arbitrary network and you put in a pulse. Initially, that pulse will be represented in the direction v in firing rate space, right? The direction of the feed-forward connectivity. After some time, it will evolve to a direction wv, w squared v, and so on. And it'll propagate, the impulse response of the network will propagate over time. You can characterize the signal amplification profile of this network as just simply the sum squared activity of all the neurons, w to the kv. For any arbitrary network, it will go up and down, right? Now, you can construct the equivalent delay line, right, that has the same signal amplification profile, right? And you can ask, what's the memory curve of the equivalent delay line compared to the same network, to this arbitrary network W? And the theorem is, the Fisher information of any arbitrary network W will be less than or equal to the Fisher information, the Fisher memory curve of the equivalent delay line, right?
So are you guaranteed you can construct equivalent delay line?
Yes.
By the theorem, is that obvious?
It's fairly obvious, yeah.
If you're smarter, it's fairly obvious.
No, you can be dumb too, it's okay.
Is that just because there is another
game? Yeah. No, I mean, it's actually, sorry, it's totally trivial, right? I mean, you construct the signal amplification profile, and then you construct a set of gains that give you the same signal amplification profile. You have n equations, n unknowns, you can solve them.
Is that like triangulation from interest?
No, it's not even that complicated. It's much more simple. Yeah. We can talk about this afterwards, right? Okay, so then the statement that I must have superlinear amplification for order n time steps in order to achieve sequence memory or to have extensive sequence memory now becomes not simply a very narrow statement about a delay line. This becomes a very general statement about any network connectivity, right? Because of this inequality, right? This says that for any network, I must have superlinear amplification in order to get extensive memory. That's one take-home message.
I'm just wondering why we never saw this with your random network.
Because random networks don't have a strong hidden feed-forward structure.
What do you need to ensure in your random network to make sure it has a strong?
The only way I know how to construct these networks is to start from a delay line and do an arbitrary rotation.
Right.
Yeah. The other way you can imagine it would come up is, let's assume that a sensory system orthogonalizes a sequence of patterns. You feed this orthogonal sequence of patterns into a network that has spike timing dependent plasticity, and then your connectivity would essentially be activity one, activity two transpose. And since they're orthogonal, you essentially build that up. That's one way to get it.
So it has to be a delay line and not upper triangular. This is more restrictive than upper triangular.
Yeah, okay. So if it's upper triangular, the memory curve could be less.
Could be less.
Right.
So the optimal is a delay line.
The optimal is a delay line. You can never do better than being orthogonally equivalent to a delay line. Right, you can never do better.
Maybe one way to think about, I mean, it turns out that how big the feed-forward weights are, how non-normal a matrix is, it's a hard question to answer with a single number. It's not a scalar quantity. But one way to think of it is that whatever your matrix is under unitary transformation, the sum of the absolute squares of the elements is conserved. But when you go to the Schur basis, you have the eigenvalues on the diagonal and the feed-forward weights on the upper diagonal. So if you have big weights, big elements to start with, but you conspire to keep your eigenvalue small, then you're going to have big feed-forward weights. That's one way to think about it. In the random matrix, if you work it out, too much of the power is left in the eigenvalues.
And we in our paper, we have a matrix called the spatial Fisher information matrix that turns out to be the identity for any normal matrix, and turns out to be something other than identity for non-normal matrix. So that's actually, I talked to actually Mark Embray, one of the authors of the book, and he had never seen that before. It's a new order parameter for non-normality. It's actually a matrix, not a number. And that actually plays a role in the proofs that I constructed. Okay, so now what? So now we've shown that to get extensive memory, you must have superlinear amplification for order n time steps, which can't be mediated by networks of neurons, where each neuron operates within a limited dynamic range. Right? So this arrives, of course, due to saturating nonlinearity. So the question is, what's the best that you can do if you do have limited dynamic range, where for a given synaptic drive, your output firing rate saturates and the synaptic drive becomes large? So we know that, and let's say we're limiting ourselves to operating in the linear regime, right? So then we know that we need superlinear amplification. We can't get around that. But one way to amplify inputs is not to amplify the firing rates of individual neurons, but to spread activity out across many neurons, right? So a simple idea that you might come up with in the beginning is imagine a divergent chain like this, where the number of neurons grows linearly with the number of stages, right? And let's say you put a pulse in, and the gain of these things is set so that the activity of individual neurons doesn't explode. It remains order one. But since you're copying the information across multiple neurons, you get actually linear amplification, right? OK, so this will get you memory, but what is the memory capacity? The memory capacity of the system is not now the number of neurons, it's the depth of this sort of fan-out network, which is L, say the depth of the network. But what is L in terms of the number of neurons? It's the square root of the number of neurons. Right. So at least this is an example where you can at least get to the square root of the number of neurons. And again, your network doesn't need to look like this. It could be any orthogonal rotation of this. So this suggests that as input comes into the network, it gets more and more distributed over time. It spreads out its activity along many more sure modes of activity. Right? Now again, you can ask me, am I suffering from a lack of imagination? Can I do better than this with neurons that operate in a limited dynamic range? And the answer is again, no. So I proved another theorem. For any network where you're operating in the linear regime, but you have a constraint on the total activity of any single neuron to be order one, then the memory capacity can never be bigger than square root of n over epsilon. And this is realizable because I just gave you an example of a network that achieves this limit. Okay. Now, a friend of mine, Taro Toyozumi, has done some interesting work where he looked at a different mode of activity, not linear propagation, but essentially binary propagation, where you make this gain so large, you make this the slope of this curve bigger than one here. So this activity propagates down a chain, it either gets driven to either the full firing rate or the zero firing rate. So if you're willing to operate in this digital regime, it's easy to imagine you can get a chain of neurons where the memory lasts order n. But actually, there's a factor n over log n, right? So this tells you that so I'm not going to talk about that here, but this just tells you that if you have neurons operating in linear regime, then the best you can do is square root of n. If you move to a digital regime, you can get up to n over log n. That you have to digitize your input before it enters the network.
So brains should go out and buy some DRAM, huh?
Yeah, it's not clear that evolution has bought DRAM, but anyway, that's a separate issue. Maybe in some cases it has. Okay, so now to put it all together, so put together nonlinearity in different architectures. I did a simulation here where you take a fan-out architecture, a divergent chain of about 135 layers, so it has about 9,000 neurons. And I put a saturating nonlinearity on the transfer function between neurons, and I rotated the network. So the actual simulations that you see here are not from this architecture, but from a rotated version of the architecture. And you can look at this the theoretical memory curve computed from the linear approximation is this memory curve here. This is the accompanying curve for a random Gaussian matrix of the same size. Right. So you can see that this even a rotated version of this architecture with nonlinearity, as you'll see here, outperforms a random Gaussian network. And this is the reconstruction error. This is how much error you'll get when you reconstruct the inputs. This is the linear approximation to both the fan-out architecture, rotated fan-out, and the random Gaussian, right? So this is an example where the blue is the actual input fed to the network, and the red is the reconstruction. And as predicted by the linear theory, even in the nonlinear network, the reconstruction goes out to about 135 time steps given determined by the 135 layers. Okay, so it all sort of fits together even when you put in the nonlinear saturation.
After that,
it gets killed, right? Because if this were continuous time, the memory would decay away exponentially with a width given by the single neuron time constant. Since this is discrete time, it gets killed immediately. You lose it very quickly. There's a sharp transition. Now you can get around that by adding a little bit of positive feedback. What that does is it drops the memory curve by the theorem that as soon as you add positive feedback, you're no longer a delay line, so you must do worse than the delay line. But because of the positive feedback, you can extend the memory even further. So this highlights actually a general trade-off between memory for the distant past and the recent past. If you want to extend the memory for the distant past, you'll necessarily take a hit for memory from the recent past. And there's a precise mathematical theorem that codifies that intuition that I won't tell you about. Okay, good. There's half an hour left. All right, so we can have some fun now, a little bit of fun, not too much. So the original idea was of a liquid state machine. So we can go back to this idea, is the surface of water a good memory device? And the answer is no, because it's a normal dynamical system. It's the wave equation. If you imagine there's sort of a pitter-patter of rain on the surface of the water that gives you noise, pretty soon the amplitude of ripples will exponentially decay down to the noise level. Not exponentially, but it'll decay down to the noise level, and soon you'll forget memory. You'll forget the size of your inputs and your location of your inputs. So you can ask just a fun question is, what is a good liquid state machine? Right? So actually, people tried to build a liquid state machine by having acoustic signals come into actuators and actually shake a body of water. And then they tried to reconstruct the acoustic signals from the body of water, and they got decent reconstruction performance for a short amount of time. Right? But you could ask, what's a good liquid state? And it turns out that there's a long history of non-normal dynamics and fluid mechanics, and it turns out that all of these types of fluid flows that are operating at high Reynolds numbers but below the onset of turbulence, it turns out that these are the kind of fluid flows that would give you memory. And we have a phenomenological model of that in it, and we can get extensive memory for a continuous space network operating in continuous times. This is your question. So this is, you have diffusion, drift, and a localized amplifying nonlinearity, so wave packets get exponentially amplified and decay away. And it turns out that the memory is proportional to the time in which the wave packet spends in the amplifying regime. So all of this generalizes to continuous space, continuous time without a problem. So let me give you a summary so far. So the take-home message is the following. So this, I guess, answers David's question, but he's asleep. So David, this is the answer to your question. Why do non-normal networks have bad memory? So again, non-normal networks are characterized by homogeneous feedback. Normal networks. Why do they have bad memory? They're essentially, their entire dynamics is characterized by homogeneous feedback loops. So what happens in such networks is no matter how the signal enters, you cannot amplify the signal without amplifying noise in the same fashion. Therefore, the integrated signal-to-noise ratio doesn't enjoy an extension due to the number of neurons. Right? Why can a non-normal network evade this? It turns out that again, a key feature of non-normal networks is this hidden feed-forward architecture. This hidden feed-forward architecture gives you an intrinsic anisotropy in the network state, such that you can preferentially amplify signal without amplifying noise by preferentially putting the signal near the beginning of the feed-forward cascade. And in general, for a generic network, you can actually optimize the feed-forward connectivity and figure out how best to distribute the signal across all the networks. If there's long-range connections, it won't be just at the beginning. Right? So again, non-normality allows differential amplification of signal and noise, and therefore you can get memory. Right? So now we're going to go to the next part of the talk and ask, okay, so here noise is the limiting factor, right?
Can I just make sure I mean?
Sure.
So epsilon is the total noise, or epsilon is the noise of
epsilon
a single
neuron? Epsilon is the variance of the noise entering a single neuron.
Single neuron.
It's
so
epsilon per neuron.
It's epsilon per neuron.
Per neuron.
Right.
Okay.
So just to make sure, you constrain the eigenvalue of your network to be
less than one.
Less than one.
In absolute value.
If they are one, you have a naturally stable network.
So that was the example I gave of the gain. This is a network that never forgets, but then the noise amplifies linearly.
Right.
So the signal to noise goes down as a power law. And the memory is logarithmic in the number of neurons.
But you could have each unit unconnected to other units and a threshold, in which case you could build the 2 to the n memory.
Well,
okay, we'll speak
about the noise can make cause transitions between those 2 to the n states, so it's not clear. Yeah, we should talk about that, but you basically need an exponentially large ball around each state that can serve as a coding state. So it's not obvious that that can be made to work. But it's an interesting idea that I think deserves further exploration. Boris? So
probably an irrelevant and disconnected question. So Marcelo Magnasco talks about critical...
Yeah, I've read his paper, the anti-Hebbian tuning. Right.
Right. So what is happening there? So there he, if I remember correctly, and I really don't remember, he is setting up a bunch of zero modes.
Exactly. So what he is doing...
Otherwise normal.
I'm not sure if it's exactly normal. I mean, the plasticity rule is exerting a force on the connectivity, which is XX transpose, which is where X is the current activity. So the plasticity is driving a normal perturbation of the network. But I'm not sure that the integrated network connectivity always remains normal. And also, Marcelo, I talked to him about this. Marcelo doesn't demonstrate that this network is good for anything, right?
So
I need to talk to him more. I wanted to email him and ask him, can his networks code information, right?
Okay, so I guess my question is going to be whether he is getting something from his normal but non-generic.
Yeah. I think that's a really exciting question. Yeah.
But you're saying that he is already non-normal and non-generic.
I think so. Yeah. I mean,
he needs to do something more than non-normality to get whatever it is that.
Yeah. If his network is being driven by noise, then he needs to do something, right? His network is a beautiful example of how you can get an extensive number of zero modes in a self-organized manner, right? But it's not clear that if you drive the system with noise, it will differentially amplify signal and noise in an intelligent way, right?
But the bottom line is, as you sort of answered to a question before, just getting an extensive number of zero modes or whatever, ones in your network, from your point of view, isn't good enough because you still got that...
Because you get the amplification of noise, exactly. That's the key. That was the middle delay line, right? That's sort of a cartoon you can keep in your mind that holds for any network that has an extensive number of zero modes, right? Okay, but now what if noise is not the fundamental barrier to memory, right? What happens even if there were no noise, right? So Herbert Jaeger in 2001 proved a very interesting theorem that showed that even with zero noise, one cannot accurately reconstruct Gaussian distributed inputs for more than n time units into the past. Right? So even with zero noise, you can't do better than n. And this roughly, the intuition for this is with n analog quantities, you can't hope to remember more than n analog inputs. Right? That's the rough intuition behind this theorem. But the theorem is much more elegant than just that. Right? Now, an interesting question is, of course, Gaussian inputs are not necessarily a kind of statistics that's relevant for the external world. Can we prove theorems about more relevant statistics while still maintaining some level of generality? Right? And one important deviation from Gaussianity in signals in the natural world is essentially sparsity. Right? So at any given time, not all, say, wavelet coefficients of an acoustic signal are active. Only a small number are. Right? And for many, many signals, it's the case that in some basis they're sparse. So if the input signal is temporally sparse, can we actually break this limit? What kind of networks can break this limit, and how do they operate? So the idea is to use, so again, we only have n neurons, but we want to remember more than n units of time of input. Right? So the idea is, can we use compressed sensing to recover high-dimensional sparse signals from small numbers of measurements?
Before you go to the sparse limit, let me go back to Sophie's question. If you really are going to go into an extremely low noise limit, wouldn't you gain a lot from going to binary representation?
So if you have 2 to the n inputs, if you can make
the noise smaller than...
So let's say you have binary signals, right? So a signal that lasts t time steps will have 2 to the t possibilities.
Right.
And if you have n neurons, you'll have 2 to the n possibilities. So then you still get n is order t. So that's the proof that idea will not work. I just came up with that. Right, does that make sense?
So, oh, you cannot beat the N.
You cannot beat the N. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
If you have continuous inputs.
But you can easily realize that N equals to T or T equals to N.
Yeah, you can realize that, right.
If you have continuous inputs, but binary units, and the initial input is strong enough to make each unit switch from 0 to 1 or 1 to 0, and then the noise will never strong enough to make the switch back.
I don't understand what you're saying, because you want to remember the whole sequence, right? So with n analog quantities or n binary quantities, you can't remember more than n binary quantities. That I don't see how you can get around that. Okay, so we're going to look at a different limit now. But to first understand this limit, we need to understand something about compressed sensing. So I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit about compressed sensing. Then I'm going to go back to the problem of memory and show you why memory could be relevant, or why compressed sensing could be relevant for memory. So what is compressed sensing? So imagine, again, you have a temporal input that's high dimensional, t time steps. You essentially measure it using a network, using effective measurement matrix A, and you get some pattern of activity x. And from your pattern of activity x, which is n dimensional, where n is the number of neurons, you want to be able to reconstruct the past input, right? So now, in general, this is hopeless, right? Because you have a t minus n dimensional space of signals that are consistent with your measurement constraints, right? So in general, reconstructing the true signal S0 from x is an ill-posed problem, right? But if the t dimensional signal has only a fraction f of the elements non-zero in some basis, and let's say you take n measurements where alpha is the degree of subsampling, alpha is n over t, is less than 1, right? Can you reconstruct the inputs? So what's an algorithm you could use to reconstruct the inputs? One approach to constructing an estimate of the true signal from x when the true signal is sparse is to try to find a signal consistent with your measurement constraints that has the smallest number of non-zeros. Again, this is NP-hard because it's a combinatorial optimization problem. You can relax this to an LP minimization. Again, I talked about this in my tutorial, but just to review very quickly. So you can minimize the LP norm of the signal. This is non-convex, but suddenly becomes convex as soon as P becomes 1. So can you imagine increasing P from 0 to 1? And that's the first non-convex problem in this relaxation of the combinatorial optimization problem, right? So again, the intuition, why might this work? You can imagine this minimization as you have your network activity x. This is the space of signals consistent with your network activity, the space of past signals. The true signal is sparse, so it lies along the coordinate axis. And minimizing the L1 norm subject to this constraint is equivalent to taking an L1 ball and expanding it until it hits your measurement constraint surface. And if it's sparse, chances are likely that your L1 ball will first hit the measurement surface at the true signal. But of course, it's not guaranteed because the true signal could have been here. So a central question in compressed sensing is, when does it even work, right? So again, this is the algorithm. The central question in compressed sensing, when is perfect recovery possible? When is the estimate equal to S0? So a traditional approach that's been followed by sort of many brilliant mathematicians is they try to find sufficient conditions on the measurement matrix such that perfect recovery is guaranteed. And they prove some pretty good sufficient conditions. But for many large random measurement matrices which violate these sufficient conditions, you nevertheless get good signal reconstruction. So the approach that we took was we tried not to prove sufficient constraints, but we rather took a statistical mechanics approach. Is we just wanted to compute the typical performance of L1 minimization as a reconstruction algorithm for given alpha and f. Alpha is the degree of subsampling, f is the sparsity of the signal for random measurement matrices. So how do we set up the statistical mechanics problem? We define an energy function on the space of candidate signals whose ground state is the solution to the L1 minimization. So we have a quadratic term here. So AS0 is the true signal. We don't know what it is. But we search a space of candidate signals and we force in measurement space that there be a small deviation, right? So the measurements you would get from if the signal were S minus the measurements you actually got, which is X, should be small. So we have a quadratic penalty on that, and we have a sparsity penalty in our candidate signal. So this gives us an energy function. We'll eventually take lambda to infinity so that this energy function concentrates on signals that do not have any deviations in measurements. We can construct a Gibbs distribution at a certain inverse temperature beta, and again, later we'll take beta to infinity, so that again, the ground states of this Gibbs distribution concentrate on the solution of this L1 minimization problem. Now we compute the typical error as a function of alpha and f. We compute the integral over the space of candidate signals of s minus s0 squared over this Gibbs distribution, right? Now, this Gibbs distribution, of course, depends on this measurement matrix A, and it depends on the true signal S0. So in the language of physics, these quantities play the role of quench disorder in this thermal distribution, in this thermal Gibbs distribution here. So we want to compute this error and average over the quench disorder. And the reason we can do this, it turns out if the matrices, are, if N and T are large enough, the typical error that you'll get for any one instantiation of A and S0 will be very close to the error that you get if you average the error over all A and S0, right? So it turns out this average is something that can be computed.
So when you're averaging over A, what's your distribution of A?
Yeah, so we choose random measurement matrices. So A is a random Gaussian matrix.
Random Gaussian.
Yeah, right.
And S0 lives on a sphere or something?
S0 is a random sparse vector. So the distribution of the non-zero elements is arbitrary, but only a fraction F are non-zero.
That's and F is fixed.
That's a parameter of the problem.
Exactly F or F on average?
It turns out it doesn't matter either way.
So can you write down the position function for this or not? That's the hard part, right?
That's the hard part, right? And that's the part I'm going to skip.
What was the question, Peter?
So you wrote equal sign. It's actually proportional to divided by Z, right? For PG of S.
Oh, sorry, yeah. There's a 1 over Z here. I'm sorry, yeah.
Z is
the partition function. Right, so using standard techniques from statistical physics, this replica theory, we can construct a mean field theory for compressed sensing. There's a nice geometry behind the mean field theory. No, I'm going to skip it. I'm sorry, Sarah.
Okay.
We'll talk about this after, during wine and cheese.
Okay.
All right. But let me just tell you the results. All right. So, okay, so now remember.
What's the steps?
Yeah, let's talk about our wine and cheese. Yeah. I mean, the steps is just replica theory, right? You've worked with that. So we'll talk about it after, yeah. But let me just give you the results.
Yes.
So these are the results. So here what I did was for any value of F, which is the sparsity of the signal, and any value of alpha, which is the degree of subsampling, I just ran an L1 simulation on a bunch of different points in parameter space. Here I always got failure. Here I always got success. A black point is where I got a mixed result, right? So you can see that at least from simulations, there's a transition, a phase transition in the behavior of compressed sensing. For any given level of sparsity, I have to have a certain number of measurements before which I get success. And as the sparsity goes down, I can have less measurements to get success. This red curve is a theoretical curve that we computed from the theory, and you can see that there's a nice match between theory and experiment. Now, some history, David Donahoe and company actually discovered this phase transition, and they also came up with a theory for this phase transition using very complicated mathematics involving convex geometry. Ours is essentially another proof of the, not a proof of the existence of this phase transition, but a characterization of this phase transition using completely different methods from statistical mechanics. And the take-home message is the following. As f becomes small, this phase transition boundary asymptotes to f log 1 over f, right? And this is what you'd expect from entropic arguments, right?
Where would the optimal matrix live in this space?
So it's very hard, no one knows. It's very hard to design optimal measurement matrices because when humans design measurement matrices, we put in correlations unwittingly into the matrix elements, right? And because we put in these correlations, they destroy the ability of these measurement matrices to perform compressed sensing. It turns out that you actually can't do better than this up to a constant factor because of information theoretic arguments. So it turns out random matrices are the optimal measurement matrices for compressed sensing up to a constant factor.
In the limit of
large N and large T.
Large N, large
right.
T, and small f.
And any f. Oh, sorry, yeah, small f, small f.
So is this basically saying that if you're in the above the line,
yeah,
that any random matrix is going to give you
any good. Random matrix will get you good results, right? And the sufficient conditions
on the line, you have to find the
yeah.
right one.
Yeah. And the sufficient conditions are actually much stronger. They sometimes tell you that you have to be in this region, to get good reconstruction performance. So clearly, if you're in this region, you violate the sufficient conditions, but you're in the success regime from the perspective of StatMax.
It's not just small f, it's any f, right?
Yeah, this curve holds true for every f, but the information theoretic argument holds for small f.
What is the order of surface transition?
That's a good question. So that's the next slide. So an open question in statistical mechanics, in compressed sensing, at least theoretically, was if you fail, what happens, right? If you're in this regime, is there a catastrophic failure rendering compressed sensing essentially useless because you just get a catastrophic failure, right? So the idea is, for a given f, as you decrease alpha from 1 down to 0, does the error suddenly jump? So in the language of physics, is this a first order or a second order transition? So now, okay, so the interesting thing is this phase boundary is universal in the sense that it doesn't depend on the statistics of the non-zeros in your signal, right? However, the nature of the transition really does depend on the statistics of the non-zeros in your signal. So if your distribution of non-zeros has a gap, right? So if your signal is non-zero, then it has a minimum probability, S min, so that there's a gap away from zero. Then L1 minimization does bad because L1 minimization forces the reconstruction to be close to zero. Right. So you get a very sharp rise in the error, but it's still continuous. Right. If your distribution of non-zeros is more confined to the origin, you get a shallower rise in the error. Right. And the blue is simulations, the red is theory, it all matches up. And basically this is a take-home message. If your signal's non-zeros are close to the origin to begin with, compressed sensing, even the error regime, will have a shallow rise in the error. Right. An open question in the field, at least theoretically, I mean, it can be gotten using simulations, is if you make errors, what are the nature of the errors? And we can find the conditional distribution of the reconstruction given the true signal, which I'll skip. And we can ask, how does the L1 and L0 norm behave? But I'm going to skip that. And you can talk about high-dimensional data analysis, but I'm going to skip that. And we're going to get back to memory, right? OK, so what does compressed sensing have to do with memory? Yeah?
Empirically, compressed sensing algorithms often seem to work even when the data isn't truly sparse in the sense of having, you know, existing.
Yeah, there's theorems that guarantee why they should work. If, in some basis, the coefficients drop off faster than a power law, then it turns out that the tail will not screw up your reconstruction of the signal up to the sort of k largest elements.
And do you see this in the StatMax?
Yeah, so we can, I mean, if we wanted to, we could analyze that by choosing a distribution of the signal and just working out the StatMax, but we haven't done that. But I'm almost virtually certain that we would see the correct answer. Right? This could be a cottage industry, which I don't want to enter. Okay, so what now? What is the relationship between compressed sensing and memory? So implicitly, any memory network is always doing compressed sensing. This is a general statement, right? So you have a temporal stream of input that could be arbitrarily long, right? Extending up to, I don't know, minutes or the lifetime of the organism. We don't know how long it could get. It enters a network, but it affects the activity of the network. It stores the information only in N neurons to remember a possibly infinite stream of temporal input. So this is really compressed sensing. But the effective measurements that a dynamical network is making is a funny set of measurements. So if you think of a signal coming in k time steps in the past, what's its effect on the network state? So first, it goes through the connectivity V, and then percolates around the network k times. And then its effect on the nth neuron is essentially W to the kV times its nth component. Right? So this is the effect, or the measurement, that the nth neuron takes on a signal entering k time steps in the past. So from the perspective of the theory of compressed sensing, this is a horrible measurement matrix, potentially, because the columns decay over time. So V has norm 1, WV has a smaller norm, and so it could increase, but eventually it decays. So the columns of the effective measurement matrix are decaying over time, and the columns could be correlated with each other, right? Because if you put a pulse into the network, there's no reason that the evolving network representation should be anti-correlated over time. Right? So, So the question is it even possible to do compressed sensing with a recurrent network? Right, that's the question. And if so, what network can do it? Okay, fine. So this is a complicated measurement matrix. We don't know if it'll work, and we don't know how to analyze it theoretically. So we're going to make a drastic approximation, right? We're going to assume that the measurement matrix is essentially zero mean Gaussian with a variance rho to the 2k, where rho decays as e to the minus 1 over tau, where rho is a decay factor, e to the minus 1 over tau n. Right, so the idea is, instead of having these columns be of this form, we just pick random vectors, but we have their norm decay over time. And we have the decay time constant be proportional to n. So tau is like a rough network integration time constant in units of the number of neurons. Again, we're interested in networks that can remember order n units of time, so we must have the integration time be order n.
So the statistical mechanics calculation that you did want to show us, right.
I'm sorry, Sarah.
Is it replicas symmetric?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. I was just wondering about the validity of your anneal approximation.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. Yeah.
I'm confused why, to the compressed sensing, you're taking in n times t inputs, and you have an n by t measurement.
Right.
Why is it compressed?
Oh, because t is bigger than n. You're taking in t inputs, but you're only making n measurements. So your measurement matrix is n by t, where t could be arbitrarily large. In fact, we'll take t to infinity.
It's really, the decay is opposite of what you had earlier, where the norm grew, right?
Say that again?
The decay, you rho to the decay, right? That's the decaying norm. So the non-normal matrix, the norm grew for a while, and then decayed.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so...
And we're no longer in non-normal matrix land?
Yeah, we are assuming there's a decay, and it will turn out that the matrix that does this will also have a decay. Yeah, so we're stepping away from non-normal matrices now. Okay, so you can think of this sequence of vectors, A and K, each column, as you move down the columns, as the evolving network response to a pulse of input, right? And I'm arguing, or I'm optimistically hoping, that this evolving network response is decorrelated across time as much as it can be. And it, of course, will decay. So I capture the decay in a dynamical system, but I do a drastic approximation where I neglect the temporal correlations. And we can ask, how well does this do? That's the first question we'll ask. And the second question we'll ask is, what kind of network might come close to this? And this will actually relate to Marcello's results a little bit more. All right. So we're... Yeah, I'll be done in time for wine and cheese, don't worry. All right, so now we can define an error function, which is the estimate of our signal, right, minus the true signal squared, as a function of time into the past, averaged over A and S0, okay? Now this estimate of the signal is obtained using L1 minimization. Now I just want to make a philosophical point. I don't believe that the brain is using L1 minimization to reconstruct inputs. Indeed, I don't think the brain is actually reconstructing inputs. L1 minimization here is just a simple theoretical tool in order for us to assess the memory capacity of a system if the system were to reconstruct inputs. Right? Having said that, L1 reconstruction can actually be implemented by neural networks, and there's various papers that show how to do that. Okay, so now this is an error function. It must increase over time. Right? Again, we have to average over A and S0, and this is a complicated statistical mechanics problem. So for a given F, say the fraction of non-zero elements is 0.04, the memory, and for any given tau, the memory increases over time. The error increases over time, so the memory decays over time. Right? Now the red are theoretically computed memory curves, and the blue are from simulation, so they match up. Now here are some take-home messages that are about to come up, right? That are, I think, independent of all the details. So the principal feature of this is, again, a trade-off between memory for the distant past and the recent past. For any given F, if you try to optimize memory for the distant past by integrating your network time, you might actually shoot yourself in the foot because of interference from the distant past. So the way you can see this is so one way to characterize the memory capacity using a single number is just to ask when the error rises to half its asymptotic value, which is always one in these units. So this is the memory capacity, t one half, right? And you can ask, how does t one half behave as a function of tau for any given f? So it turns out that for any given f, the memory capacity rises as you increase the integration time constant from zero, but then decays. So there's an optimal value. How do we understand this optimum? So again, this arises from the trade-off, right? If tau is too small, you forget quickly, right? But if tau is too long, you never forget the distant past, and then the recent past interferes. The distant past interferes with your memory for the recent past. So for any given tau, for any given f, there's an optimal integration time. As f gets smaller, you reduce the problem of interference, allowing tau to become larger to get to the optimum. And then so you can ask, what is the optimal memory as a function of f? And it turns out it actually diverges as f goes to zero. And it turns out that the take-home message is that the memory capacity is n over f log 1 over f. So again, this is the best you can do up to constant factors from information theoretic arguments, right? But now here's the big question. This is the behavior of the annealed approximation that I made, and it's not clear that any network can realize this annealed approximation, right? So the open question for neuroscience is there a network that can realize this, right? So again, the annealed approximation, ANK, is the activity pattern across neurons, k time steps after an input stimulus. And I want these patterns to be decorrelated across time, right? We want ANK and ANL, two columns, to be as different and uncorrelated as possible. So it turns out that this can be achieved if the network connectivity is orthogonal. So if O is an orthogonal matrix, and W is some decay factor times an orthogonal matrix, then it turns out that W will just rotate the activity over time. So the time evolving response will change in sort of an uncorrelated way. And the way you can understand this is the eigenvalue spectrum of an orthogonal matrix is a ring of radius rho. Right? So of a radius square root of rho. So essentially what happens is you have n order n modes of activity that take order n time steps to decay. So essentially, this column vectors will rotate about in the high n-dimensional space for order n time steps. And
the ley line again?
So that's an interesting question. It turns out, so if you look at a delay ring, right, a delay ring will have eigenvalues that are uniformly spaced on this circle, right? So it turns out that most orthogonal matrices are actually, for all practical purposes, equivalent to delay rings. However, a delay ring will not work as well here because a delay ring has a strict periodicity of n, whereas because of the randomization in the positions of eigenvalues, you don't get the strict periodicity of n, which allows the memory to extend beyond n. Right?
So this is all in the noiseless case, right? With noise.
Yeah. So if the noise is order, if noise is high, you need to combine the two approaches, or if the noise is order 1 over n, then this won't change this picture. So now we can go back to the essential conjecture that can random matrices give you memory? And again, in this framework, random Gaussian matrices cannot, because the eigenvalue spectrum of random Gaussian matrices is uniformly distributed on a disk. So if you iterate the vector v by repeatedly multiplying by w, the projections of v onto the eigenmodes near the center of the disk will rapidly decay away. Therefore, the sequence of vectors will rapidly be confined to a low-dimensional subspace of network activity, and it will be impossible to reconstruct the distant past from the evolving network response of the network. Okay, so
I'm still confused.
Sure.
So before you showed us that to change 1 over epsilon to n over epsilon, you
right.
have to be non-normal.
Right.
Now there's no epsilon.
So you can think of
saying to change.
So if you think of epsilon as 1 over n, you automatically get n over epsilon for free, right? So this is a high, small noise limit. Right? So you can imagine each of these modes is reflecting a large number of neurons, which does the noise reduction for you, and then they hand off the activity to each other.
Wait, but if epsilon is 1 over n, so then you're going from n to n squared, you know, n for normal to n squared.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And here you're getting n for.
Yeah,
normal,
I'm getting n.
Right. So this
exactly.
is just. This is still just within the.
Right, but I'm getting more than n, right? I'm getting n over f log 1 over f. But a delay line would not be able not let me get that.
But how are you evading your previous result that it's less than 1 over epsilon for a null matrix?
So again, so this is the zero noise limit. In order to add noise and get the same results, I have to have epsilon be 1 over n.
Yeah, but even your previous result didn't depend on the size of epsilon, did it? Your previous limit?
No, it didn't depend on the size of epsilon. But
so it should work even for epsilon tiny, right?
Yeah, but then the noise could destroy the results, right? If the noise is order 1.
We'll talk
about it afterwards. Yeah.
So something I don't understand is this metric that's optimal here exactly the one that's actually suboptimal for the noisy case? That is, you don't want.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
You want to be able to diagonal the right metric in the noisy case because then
that's right. Yeah. So I mean, this is a different constraint in memory. Here, noise is not the issue. Sparsity is the issue, right? If noise and sparsity are an issue, you can easily imagine combining both.
It really sucks that they go in exactly the opposite direction.
It's interesting, right? I mean, this is the usual thing with networks or any input-output map that's optimized. The map is different for high SNR and low SNR. Yeah.
So what is the impediment for doing sparse sensing with non-normal matrices here?
Oh. I mean, you can do it, but you also need positive feedback. For example, if you just had a delay line, your information about the past will automatically be cut off at n. But here, your information about the past can exceed n. Right? But so again, I guess I should have some slides in combining the two methods. But if you have both positive feedback and non-normality, then you can potentially combat noise and get memory that exceeds n, right, where n is the number of modules.
Positive feedback would, for example, go into a discrete.
Right, something like that. I mean, this is something I need to work out. Yeah, I don't have all the answers to you right now. Okay, so now we can have the take-home messages and then go to wine and cheese. So I started off with this example of a monkey remembering a sequence, and it turned out that the internal representation of a single object changed over time. Right? And one might think that this might be a weakness of the brain, that the brain just can't simply maintain stable persistent activity. But what we learned by doing the theory is the following, that sequence memory is actually quite a difficult problem because there's multiple conflicting design constraints on sequence memory networks. On the one hand, they're memory networks, so they must maintain stable internal representations in order to remember the distant past. On the other hand, while still remembering the distant past, they must be free to acquire more recent inputs. So they need to have flexibility of their internal representations. And if there's noise, they must be able to amplify input signals without destructive noise amplification. So the first part of this talk was that if you have all three problems, non-normal networks characterized by this possibly hidden feed-forward structure, but not purely feedback networks, essentially achieve all three. And they also, like the macaque brain, exhibit dynamical short-term memory representations. That is, the representation of the distant past changes in order to make way for the recent past. Within the general class of networks, only non-normal networks can do this. But now, if you consider a different limit, a limit where the signal-to-noise ratio is high, and the signal statistics is sparse. Remember, here the signal statistics is Gaussian, here the signal statistics is sparse. In this different limit, you can use ideas for compressed sensing to lead to improved memory. And the memory perform, but again, you must have these dynamically evolving network representations. And just one last thing, I showed you that sort of the optimal network to get this was an orthogonal network, but that's a network operating in discrete time. If you were to do this in continuous time, which is what the brain would do, you would have to have an anti-symmetric network. So generically, if one neuron is exciting another neuron, the neuron itself should inhibit the previous neuron. So if you have this anti-symmetry and you have some kind of global inhibition to keep the activity from decaying away, from exploding, then when you exponentiate it, you get orthogonal networks. So that's what you might expect. Yeah.
How sensitive are you to just small breaks in orthogonality?
Oh, you can add a random Gaussian matrix and it won't change the results. Essentially, for most of these results. Yeah?
You were here the first week, right?
Yeah.
Were you here for John's talk, the very first talk, the first?
John Hopfield's talk, yeah, sure, yeah.
So
that's where this all started. I mean, the field started. Yeah.
Yeah, but his, so in that talk,
right.
It seemed to me there was a completely sort of flipped
okay.
view of how to approach this problem, right? Rather than trying to take the state and read out past states,
right.
He was putting forward the idea that you trigger a state,
right.
and then it plays forward.
Right. That's essentially what's happening here as well, right? If you were just to remember a single input, this would predict that even for a single input, the evolving network, the network should evolve over time, i.e. you should not maintain persistent activity in order to remember even a single input, if you expect that same network to remember more recent inputs as well. But even if they don't arrive, it should change over time.
I think the question that, if I understand this question correctly, is how can you learn a specific sequence without this, within this, so that
so that's the yeah.
element, and then the dynamics of the network itself takes you to the second, third, fourth, takes
yeah,
you to
well,
the
I mean, that's what John presents.
Which is the kind of things that John talks
that,
about.
That you learn in the in the synaptic waves.
Yeah, so that's
how it
that's
plays forward
problem.
Once you trigger it.
Yeah, that's a different problem. That's learning sequences that you've seen before. This is just sort of, so
okay.
yeah.
But if you
but actually
take
you,
something like his solution
right.
for how to learn it, you're saying that this analysis applies to his
yeah, it could potentially in the following way, right? So here we were looking at stimulus reconstruction as a measure of the memory capacity, right? But if you want to compute any complicated function of the past sequence, for example, you want to compute the next sequence, right, given the past of a sequence, right? You could have the same network that just stores the information about what particular past sequence you got without any plasticity. And then you can have a readout network that's trained to predict the next part of the sequence given the current network state, which is a proxy for the past sequence.
Well, actually, Surya, if you think of this old you know, paper of Haim with...
Sure.
Chris
Dante? Sample and screen climb files?
No, the sequence paper. Okay, I'll remember it in a minute. Anyway, I forget. Where essentially what you do is a heavy learning with the this pattern and the next pattern.
Yeah, sure.
Instead of doing psi I mu psi h,
so that
the mu, you do psi I mu psi j mu plus one.
Right.
Arendt, in this sense, is which is the basic, the underlying idea of
right.
these networks, to remember sequences so that you put it in one state and it will stay there for a while, make a transition
right.
for the next. You're creating pseudo-attractors
right.
that have a built-in transition
right,
for the
right,
next
right,
state.
Right, right. So that's actually a beautiful way. Yeah.
Oh, so, aren't you in some sense creating this a non-normal? Isn't that
oh, definitely,
a
yeah.
non-normal matrix because it has the structure of a delay line?
Yeah, that's
right?
that's yeah.
Although not in neurons but in patterns.
Exactly.
But you have
so that was my answer to Adrian's.
Transition from a
right.
pattern and a transition
right.
from a pattern. So it's a special case of these non-normal
exactly.
networks, but it has a learning rule built in.
Yeah. So that was my answer to Adrian's question. Is you can imagine like this kind of a learning rule building up a self-organizing a non-normal network for you.
But that learning rule is a non-normal.
Exactly.
Network.
Exactly.
It's like a delay line.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
But isn't that different if you actually try to learn specific sequence rather than memorize a generic sequence?
That was a specific sequence. The Xi I's are particular states, and you want a sequence that takes you from these. So if you give me the Xi I's, I give you the Jij's for that network.
But is it that different problem from here?
This is a capacity problem, which is different from a learning problem.
By the way, we're 10 minutes into wine and cheese, just wanted to say that.
Yeah, we should go to the wine and cheese.
Yeah.
So since you started with a monkey,
right.
and it's not unreasonable to, you know, at some point,
end
with monkey. Spike, so that's not quite there yet.
Right, right.
What would be a critical experiment you'd like to see?
Well, kinectomics would be like the killer experiment, right? But we're so far away from that.
Well, I mean just what would you like to see besides thinking about it?
So I would like to see more studies that really probe sequence memory in neural systems that demand more than just remembering one item, right? And then we need to look at the pattern of the evolving network response, see how orthogonal they are, see what dimensionality the space of patterns the space, the dimensionality of the space is. I've done a little bit of...
neurons, can you detect the non-null matrix behavior? Because, you know, the best you can get is maybe a couple hundred neurons, right?
Yeah.
So your signatures of non-null matrix
behavior. I don't know.
Well, we know that because E and I cells are separate, the matrices are non-null.
I mean, this is Sebastian Sung's sort of conjecture about HPC, is that it's this non-normal chain. But there it's explicitly a delay line, not even hidden. I mean, in answer to your question, I'd just like to see, I think we're so at the beginning of this problem that we really need more data to even characterize what's going on.
It's measured physiology data. There's no experiment that would shed some light on this.
No. But no, sequence memory experiments, right? So delayed match to sequence, that, you know, that kind of thing.
Don't you know that the intrinsic time scales are much longer?
How much what?
The intrinsic time scales of the real time, I mean, there's many time scales.
Yeah. So one way.
The main constraint here is not applicable. You have long time scales, you really know.
Right, but if the thing is, you also need the neurons to change their state, right? You can't just have membrane bistability solve the whole problem, because if you turn on a neuron in response to one input, eventually you have to shut it off for some other input to have an evolving network response, and not just have the whole every sequence drive you to one fixed point. That's the problem. Yeah.